Hi, everyone, and welcome back to this second podcast in the series with Robin Chan. Welcome to the Rural Medley. I'm Lucinda Thatcher, one of the team at the University of Otago section of Rural Health Department of General Practice, and I'm organising some podcasts. So today we are going to chat with Robin, who's a rural generalist working in Taupō, having trained in Australia. She's done some time working as a military medical officer and also as a rural Australia flying doctor in Cairns. She moved to Taupō with her family in 2018 and has an interest in a wide variety of topics. We first met really when she came and talked at the Queenstown CME workshop and covered this topic of cognitive bias in a talk there. And it was just really interesting. And so I just wanted to get Robin back with me and turn it into this format so that we could spread it a little wider. But welcome, Robin. Great to have you again.
Hi, Lucinda. It's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
Absolute pleasure. Always a pleasure chatting to you. So I'm going to hand over to you chatting about cognitive bias, and then we'll have a look at some of the details.
Yeah, cool. So I think the first thing about cognitive bias is we've all got it. And the reason why it's important is because it really influences the decisions we make clinically. In fact, it influences the decisions we make generally in life. But of course, we're here on a medical podcast, so it influences the decisions we make clinically. And that's why it's really important to be aware of. As humans, we have this very unique skill of thinking about the way we think. And the term for that is metacognition. And it's a very, it's a curious thing to be able to step outside ourselves and say, hey, how did I actually come to that conclusion? How did I make that decision? And it's something that has fascinated me for a while, but really also interests me in the realm of clinical decision making and also clinical errors as well. We are all subject to faulty reasoning, despite our talent, dedication, and compassion, because we are human. And so I think that's the first thing to realize. This is not something to be ashamed of. It's just a fact that we've all got cognitive bias.
I don't think we're very good at just in terms of making errors, like stating it that's a fact. I don't think we're really taught that at med school, are we? Or as doctors, that it's okay to make mistakes and to make errors, and that's just going to happen.
That's exactly right. And I think that is really important too, because once we can take the shame out of it, then it's much easier to learn from it, isn't it? And have that growth mindset. Diagnostic error is everywhere in every specialty. We think it's about 10 to 15% of any specialty at any one time is having diagnostic errors being made. Yeah, and I think there was a good study. I mean, it's a bit old now, but it says diagnostic error rates in specific conditions. This is adapted from some advances in patient safety, but there's some pretty impressive error rates. So, for example, ruptured aortic aneurysms. Aortic aneurysm is one of those really tricky ones to diagnose, and I think the hair goes on the back of my neck every time I hear it because it's not an easy diagnosis to make. But there was a medical center that reviewed over a 7-year period 23 cases involving abdominal aneurysms, and it was missed in 61% of patients who presented. And there's a number of other diagnoses like that. PEs are another one that get misdiagnosed out of the initial presentations an awful lot. And even pathologists who you think, well, all they're doing is looking down slides and counting red things and pink things. But even pathologists will change their mind on a diagnosis of melanoma from benign to malignant up to 11% of the time. So this is not something that is just because of junior doctors or inexperience. It happens to all of us in any specialty.
I
And
see that the dissection is in there, and a thoracic dissection, and I clearly remember a case of mine working in ED by myself and overnight and chest pain and doing the trops and doing all that sort of stuff and ECGs, and it just wasn't winning and didn't pick it up. And sadly, then he arrested, and the impact of diagnostic error can be quite profound, can't it? Because that But luckily, there was the more team there that when he arrested, because I was just like, I was probably like a first year registrar, and I just completely melted. The anaesthetic reg came in and said, "Do you want to lead it?" And I was like, "Oh no, I just can't lead that. I'm so sorry. I just felt so terrible that I'd missed this." At that stage, we didn't really know what it was, but yes, that's what it was.
I'm sure for every case like that, there's going to be hundreds more exactly like that, Lucinda, because it's a really difficult diagnosis to make. And not only that, even had you made it, it sounds like.
Yes, the chances of a good outcome potentially, but there's so many factors in it, but you just never forget those ones where you do make the diagnostic error, because that was probably a good 16 years ago now, and you still just clearly remember. It shapes you though, doesn't it? Because then when you remember those cases, and then I think it was Theodore Roosevelt, wasn't it? And I never quite remember the quote correctly, but the key is that you've got to learn from others' mistakes, because we can't make them all ourselves, and so that's where the value of the M&Ms and all that sort of stuff comes in, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And also being open to, I think we were talking in our last podcast, being in a safe enough environment where you can share those stories and feel that there is not an atmosphere of blame or judgment. There is an atmosphere and culture of support and learning. I think those are really special, your learning opportunities for everyone. But I think even when we talk about error, it's not only individuals. It's really important to realize that these are not mostly individual problems in thinking. They're often a combination of system errors and cognitive reasoning. There is also things that are purely system errors. It doesn't matter what individuals you had in there. There was a problem with the way the system was set up. And sometimes there is cognitive errors, but cognitive errors are part of also being human. But trying to understand them, I think, and reflect on how we make faulty reasoning, how our thinking becomes awry, is really important and may, in fact, help us to become better clinicians, I think.
And just quickly on that, I feel like we've got, I think we're more cognizant of the fact that, and hopefully, I think the treatment injury system is a good way of having a look at how we're now moving away from blame on the clinician and actually having a look at all those facets of why poor outcomes might occur, and trying not to blame the clinician, but to facilitate a process where we can actually look at all these different components, can't we? I think we have moved forward in that aspect, whereas in the past it was certainly more of a blame and shame.
Yeah, it's actually vital that we don't any longer blame or shame clinicians. First of all, it's almost never single clinician's fault. It's almost always a combination of things. And actually, all that happens is that we put pressure on a clinician who is probably just human, and they end up leaving a health service, which actually is in real need of great and skilled and dedicated healthcare workers. The complaints process is so stressful for individual doctors that sometimes they just choose to leave the profession.
And that is a
So it's
shame.
a real shame, yeah. So I think it's really important that we acknowledge how good it is that we've come so far and how we really need to continue to protect that space. Yeah. So I often think of errors in decision making in these three different categories. One, sometimes you just don't know, especially when you're new and you're training. This idea of you don't know what you don't know.
100%.
Yeah.
Or you say when you're new. I don't even think it's necessarily when you're new. New, there is many a time, every day. It's one of the things I love about medicine is just you're constantly learning. And one thing I loved about generalism is everything's so varied, isn't it? And every day coming in, I'm like, I'm just going to have to get back to you on that, because it's something I haven't encountered before, and I've just got to do a little bit of research. One of the things I love about my job. Yes, it was probably really bad back then, but even though there's lots I don't know, the good thing is I do identify that I don't know, which is what you're saying, is that you don't know that you don't know.
You're spot on. And I
Did I
think that,
get that round the right way?
Yeah, you totally did. And I totally agree with you. The only difference about being an older rural generalist is that, exactly as you said, you realize how much you don't know. And you go, oh, God damn it, I don't know that. I don't know. I'm going to go have to look that up. I'm going to have to phone a friend. I'm going to have to think about where you're going to have to come back. I'm going to have to send you up to. And that's, I think, the wisdom of having done this long enough to know that you don't know, or when you don't know.
Look up health pathways multiple times.
But I think that the more dangerous part is, what I mean is, when you're just coming into training, you might be a bit overconfident, right? A bit overconfident. You don't realize yet how much you don't know. And then the other one is not seeing. So, quite often the information is there in front of us, but for whatever reason, time pressures, it's before lunch, the departments are really busy, you just didn't have the time, or you just didn't quite pay attention to the things you needed to pay attention to. It might be in the examination, but sometimes I often have to pull myself up from not cutting the examination a bit short, because, oh, I think I know what it is. I think I've got enough information to really make the case, but actually, have I fully examined? Have I done a proper, whatever, pelvic exam? Or have I actually looked in the ears? Or have I actually felt for lymph nodes? Things that you often might skip. So just taking the time to really look for the information you need. And it might not be the examination, it might be, I need to check up the old results here. I need to go and see what the hemoglobin was 3 months ago to see whether actually this is a new anemia, or so on. And the third one is an error in the way we have put all the information together. And that's where their cognitive bias comes in, I think. So sometimes we just don't know. And that's where a little humility comes in. And the humility often comes with being of an age like you and I, where we've just made enough mistakes just to know that actually, I'm just going to double check. I'm just going to phone a friend. I know that actually there's a chance here that I've completely gone down the wrong path. Whereas if you're new, you haven't seen that much stuff, you haven't really, I don't appreciate that actually there are very many things that can cause this, not just one or two. You might have a false sense of security and jump to a diagnosis a little bit prematurely. When that happens, having a little bit of caution around, or a little bit of humility, or a little bit of a question of, hey, is there something here that I might not know? And a good way to flesh that out is this example that I often give about, if my daughter comes home from school, I've got two twins, and she opens the fridge and she sees that her chocolate egg is missing, and she'll slam the fridge door and she goes, oh, my sister is such a B word or something, or my sister is just so evil. All right. That's one possible diagnosis. She's seen that her chocolate's gone, and immediately she's decided that her sister's taken it, and now her sister is this evil cow. Mum could have eaten it. You could have actually not put it in the fridge. You could have put it in your room. There are a number of different things that might have happened, but she has jumped to the first conclusion, the first thing that has popped into her brain, and she has run with it. And that sometimes is the danger of not gathering enough evidence. Sometimes someone comes in with dysuria, and my doctor might go, oh, you've got a UTI, here's your Keflex. How do we know that this isn't the STI? How do we know this isn't a non-infective cause of cystitis? How do we know isn't urogenital cancer, whatever, the thrush? How do we know? It's just being able to pause that initial snap decision, be able to broaden your diagnostic net a little bit.
And we do a lot of snap decisions every day. And I suppose often we're right. And that's part of the problem, right? And recognizing when actually this doesn't fit into that nice little medical box of this diagnosis of a UTI and going, okay, what in here? And we talk about clinician gestalt, don't we? And how that sometimes we just have to rely on that to go, okay, this is a little bit different. Or time or review. but actually it should be something that we could maybe use more at the time, don't we? Just to reduce the likelihood of, or the possibility of our snap decision not being quite right.
Yeah, I completely agree. And you just explained beautifully this idea of we all have it, this type one, or you called it gestalt thinking, this fast thinking. It's really easy, it's quick, it's usually right, but it's actually error prone. And there is a high risk of cognitive bias in there, unfortunately. It's the person comes in and they might be overweight, they're in their 50s, and they say, oh, I've been really tired or something. And maybe you jump to diabetes, or your mind goes, has a preformed opinion or idea that is so ingrained in your own previous experience and probably sociocultural experience
Yeah.
that makes you want to jump towards certain conclusions early about someone. So it's usually right, but unfortunately, it is quite error prone and quite prone to bias. Whereas system two is really slow. And I use these system one, system twos because this is from a very famous book called Thinking Fast and Slow. I highly recommend it. You know what? The author just escapes me. We'll have to put it in the
Always
show.
does.
Yeah.
You have to do more system two thinking
Yeah.
and
That's
think
exactly
slower.
right. You think so, exactly.
You're way
Physically.
too fast, way too much system one, way too much chick jumping, tangential thinking, going boom, 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 boom.
That's exactly right.
It's
It
our
will come.
problem.
Yeah. But system two is that slow, analytical, but very accurate type of thinking. But the problem with system two is it takes energy. It actually takes glucose, and our brain actually doesn't like to do it because it uses up a lot of energy. It's like saying to someone, hey, do you want to walk on the flat to go and get a drink at the end of the lake, or do you want to go up Mount Tahara actually, or climb this mountain? I'm going to tend to want to just go on the flat, thanks. But and you can see this if you're driving or walking. If you're walking with a friend and you ask them to do some really complicated long division without a device, their walking will actually slow down. And I've had this experience as well when somebody's asked me something, a complicated problem, while we've been going for a walk along the lake. I've noticed myself, I'll actually slow down. If it's really cognitively difficult, if I really can't understand this question, I sometimes just stop.
Oh, interesting.
Because
I'm going to try that out.
Try it out. If you're driving and someone asks you to compute a really difficult sum, say, it's highly likely that you're going to make an error somewhere. Either you're going to take a wrong turn or have an accident, get lost. Or, if you're stewing over something, if your brain is really active and you're driving, sometimes you'll forget
Yes.
where the hell you're going.
Yes, or miss that turn off,
That's
or yeah.
exactly right. Yeah. So, the other interesting thing is these grand champion chess players who sit down for tournaments hours at a time, not doing any physical exercise, but they burn huge amounts of calories because they are so cognitively engaged for that whole time.
Wow.
Yeah, it's quite fascinating. So this idea of really hard analytic cognitive load is really it's quite hard work, and we don't really recognize it because it's hard cognitive work. But it's also the reason why, if you're, say, on the wards and a colleague comes to you and says, oh, I've got a patient in ED, I need to refer to you, they've got some gastritis but their pain hasn't really resolved, I've put in a referral for endoscopy, they just need a little bit of time overnight. And that sort of seems like a nice little package. It's framed quite well. And my brain wants to go, oh, yep, cool, just stick him in the bed. Sounds like investigations are all lined up for tomorrow, and I don't need to do anything. My brain wants to accept that package because it doesn't require much cognitive load. The alternative is, sorry, hang on. Does this patient have epigastric pain? So how do we not know that this isn't an MI? How do I not know this isn't pancreatitis? How do I not know that this isn't a gallstones? What more do I have to do? Where's can I see the ECG? What is the troponin like? Have you done a lipase? All that now is creating burden in my head, right? And my brain actually doesn't want to do it because it's creating work for me, you know. And I'm not cognitive work, right? But that is safer. You can see how that is a safer option.
100% safer. It's
And
what we should all do at handover. But there's a trust game, hopefully.
sorry.
There's a trust game. And we probably just assume that this is where the assumptions come in, don't we? We think, okay, if someone's packaged it up and they've made it gastritis, and if you trust this clinician, you're assuming that they've done all those steps and they've done all that, and this is what it's come out to be. But you're right, we shouldn't. Again, that must be some other kind of cognitive, that probably has a name to it too, doesn't it? Some other cognitive process that we don't.
Yeah, that's right. So this is a framing bias that it's been framed in a certain way, and handover times are really high risk times. So the framing effect is that we are disproportionately influenced by how our problem is dressed up, how it's described, and by whom, right? So if you've got, I don't know, someone you really respect, for example, and they've framed it up nicely, you're like, oh yeah, mate, no worries, yeah, cool, just stick them on the ward. But actually, they're really high risk times because they're the times often where we might even be towards the end of our shift, or someone's trying to get out the door, and one of the clinicians is really tired or whatever, and that's the time that we need to engage our type two thinking, but we're actually more likely to be using type one thinking. So framing is a really classic one. The other one is this premature closure, a bit like the UTI example. You know, this area, okay, it's a UTI. That's premature closure. That means that we haven't actually found enough information to support our diagnosis, or we haven't looked for other features that might disprove our original hypothesis. So we've gone that extra mile. So premature closure is a really big one, I think. Availability bias is another one. So we tend to think, okay, the first thing that pops into our head, the one that's on the top of our head, is more likely or more common. And you see this sometimes when you have runs of things. Oh, I had a lady who had a big PE the other day. Therefore, the next two or three people that come in with shortness of breath, I'm immediately, oh, they got a PE. You know, just the top of mind. Availability, it's available to us. Yeah, affective bias, I think, is a good one to talk about because that's about your own emotional stuff. For example, someone really reminds me of my grandma, so I'm going to have to be influenced by those feelings. Maybe, and that could go either way. Oh, I really don't want anything to be wrong with this woman because she reminds me of my grandma. And so perhaps you're not going to look for those more sinister diagnoses, or the other way around. You start to over investigate somebody, over treat somebody because of some emotional, influence that's happening.
I was just reading a book called The Fortunate Doctor, A Fortunate Woman by Polly Morland, I think. Anyway, that was also there's a Fortunate Man that was apparently, I think, written earlier in England. Anyway, it's a great book, highly recommend it. But it was talking about with the term heart sink patients and how we shouldn't use that phrase, and actually what we need to do as clinicians is reflect ourselves around why these patients are heart sink for us. And I started looking at it actually, and because I think in America they're like, that phrase should be gone, you know? And I suppose it should be, because it does instantly put you into a negative sort of frame of mind, doesn't it, towards the patient, and whether that then impacts on your care. And I suspect, but yeah, so I was just thinking, it just made me think. So if anyone's looking for a book, I highly recommend that. And then having just think about that concept of a heart sink patient and why they're a heart sink patient, and reflecting yourself about what that is, because that is a type of bias, isn't it? Because you tend to, particularly in primary care, with that continuity of care, you have a group of people, often a number of patients, that do create this heart sink when you see them on your template. You're like,
Absolutely, absolutely. And sometimes it's countertransference. Sometimes it's something that you're carrying that now is jumped in between you and the patient in the relationship and is now going to perhaps be really become a real barrier to some authentic care. Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. And that's another reason why it's really important to know ourselves as much as possible, because quite often if we're triggered by something in a patient, it's an opportunity to really look inward. To say, hey, what's going on there? That it's stirring something within me, and I need to find out what that's about.
Yeah, that's right, Robin.
I had this, I'm going to tell this vulnerable story because I think it really illustrates a number of biases and diagnostic errors that I made a long time ago when I was a junior doctor in the military. I was on deployment, actually. I was in the Middle East, and I had this young soldier come in, and he had these really gritty eyes, and he had dysuria. I can't pee. He had a sore knee. And I immediately flashed back to being a student. I had this very charismatic registrar who was tutoring us, and he was teaching us about writer's syndrome, post-gonococcal syndrome of sore knee, can't pee, can't see, conjunctivitis, inflammatory arthritis, and urethritis, right?
100%. The way you framed that, I was like, that's exactly what I thought of too.
Right. And I was like, oh my God, oh my God, I found one. This is amazing. I've got it, and I wanted to call up my old registrar. I go, man, you taught us so well. I remembered this. It's come in handy, and now I'm gonna save the day. Anyway.
Actually, he got tackled in the sand, didn't he? And he just landed on his knee, and then he's just got some sand in his eye, and I don't know why he can't pee. I can't explain that one.
No, yeah, that's right. You ruined my punchline, is
Oh,
in
did I? Oh no. Oh no. I am
No,
so
you're absolutely
sorry.
no, not at all. You're so clever. You're so clever.
Was making a compliment.
But you're exactly right. You're exactly right. So what had actually happened is that, yeah, he had sand in his eye because it's in the desert. Everyone's got sand in their eyes, right? He had fallen on his knee in a rapid aim fire
Oh,
drill because that's what
I'm actually
they
just taking the being silly. Okay,
No,
it was that.
you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. He had been on a drill, he'd fallen on his knee, and he'd been given shed loads of NSAIDs. And so he was not peeing well because he had actually an acute tubular necrosis and he
Oh,
was having all sorts.
wow.
Yeah. But it was a perfect example of a beautiful trifecta of premature closure. I had just jumped onto this diagnosis and I had not looked for any alternatives. Right. I had thought of the things that came top of my mind, availability bias. I thought of that, so that's what it is. I had framed it to my colleagues like that. I had said, oh, he's just been away on leave to see his partner and he's come back with this problem. It really looks like and so I had, managed to get this guy, reviewed by all sorts of people who really didn't need to see him, but because the way I framed it, there was definitely an overconfidence there because I was young and I didn't really know the number of other things it could be. So I didn't hadn't really appreciated all the other things it could be. So a bit overconfident and a bit not knowing what I don't know. And also, there's also another form of bias, which is a blind obedience, where you really defer to superiors. Now, I at this point hadn't really done that, but if you're working in a really hierarchical organization, especially if you're, say, the intern and you've got a consultant or even consultant to reg, whatever, that also can really come into play with, well, if my consultant says it's this, then it's this. And everyone will have cases in their lifetime where actually, no, you know what, the boss was wrong or the advice was wrong, but it was just never questioned because of that hierarchy we still work within. Although I think much more and more there is an understanding that at any stage of your career, you can question authority, especially when it relates to patient safety. It still plays into our biases and our decision making, without a doubt.
Absolutely. And having the confidence to challenge someone superior to yourself, or also just having the confidence in yourself that actually you might be right and the people above you might be wrong. Like that takes a bit of like I say, confidence, doesn't it, in yourself to be able to make that call and then go through with it.
And I do think that must happen a lot from general practice calling into secondary care. In fact, I know it does, that perhaps the advice you were given, didn't really ring true or didn't bear out to be the correct advice. But at no time was it really questioned because there was an understanding of this is the specialist. And I think it still is useful to have in the back of your mind that regardless of how clever and experienced the person is on the end of the phone, 10 to 15% of the time they're probably going to be wrong because that's just the statistic. And they don't have the person in front of them as you are. And that's not to at all dissuade the amazing specialist that we have in this country. That's just by nature of being a human being and being a doctor and a specialist is we're not going to get it right all the time because no one does.
And it is, it's hard on the end of the phone, isn't it, to give advice when you haven't seen the patient. We've all been in that situation, haven't we?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That being aware of those cognitive biases, I think, is helpful. And also being aware of the when they happen at handovers, they happen when time is pressured, they happen when you're tired or when you've got some personal stresses or you're cognitively overextended because you've got too many complex patients on the go or too many complex problems you're trying to solve at once. And they happen when, as you said, you have these emotional reactions that are getting in the way of you thinking clearly. If the patient is perhaps, for whatever reason, being uncooperative or you're having trouble communicating with them, if the patient has got a really difficult history with healthcare services, maybe the reputation has preceded them and that's going to be influencing you. And some of those countertransference issues as well. Just be aware those are times where your bias is going to kick in as well. And then, of course, there's environmental factors, system level factors like a lack of supervision, juniors working without support. If you're like us, work overnight without pathology or radiology on site, that can sometimes be a time where you might jump to conclusions without all the information you need. We talked last time we spoke about safety culture. If you don't have a great safety culture in your organization, that's really a time when perhaps there's going to be some cognitive biases as well that are going to show their head.
Definitely.
So how do we improve on it? Get help from colleagues, experts, tools, and checklists. So they're great things when you just don't know. When you're in training, obviously there is a health pathways and a phone a friend, use tools. Use checklists. And then, of course, have some strategies to switch yourself from type one into type two thinking. And some simple questions there are, okay, I think it's this, but if it's not this, what is it? I think it's gastritis, but if it's not gastritis, what is it? I think it's a UTI, but if it's not a UTI, what is it? Is there
I like the
any?
one of what's the most likely diagnosis here? What's the worst case scenario? And Murtagh, he's got a really good ones of, like the masqueraders. His strategy is quite good, isn't it? The things don't miss, red flags, masqueraders. Well, his strategy, can't remember them all now off the top of my head, but his is actually quite thorough.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mershall's got an excellent strategy for thinking about horses and zebras and just thinking if it, yeah, that's right. Is there anything doesn't fit? Why, what's the thing I should be most worried about? Yeah. And is there any other reason why I need to slow down or are there any tools or expertise that I need to reach out to and use really to help me with this problem? I think it's not always easy to do that because we are all time pressured. But sometimes even acknowledging that, hang on, I'm feeling really time pressured. This is going to be a time where I'm at risk of making some cognitive errors. That in itself is quite useful as a tool to help you just slow down. Yeah.
I've never really thought about thinking like that. I just sitting there and going, okay, I might make an error because of the way I'm feeling or the system, or I'm just taking more care, which actually probably is quite relevant again currently, isn't it? I like the potential for bias and errors, and with the time, I particularly in primary care, I feel like the constraints of resources, whether that be time, personnel, they all lead us to making those a premature closure, and just because of the lack of time and things, isn't it? And so actually, as you say, like just potentially starting each day of, or each shift or session or whatever you do, and just going, actually, how can I minimize this, or being aware of it as in the first instance.
Yeah, I think so. Being aware of that, those high risk times, and being aware of biases that are particular to you as well. There's going to be some biases that we each individually fall into more easily than others.
That's another interesting concept, isn't it? That there might be some that one person does more often than another. Have you got any other final closing comments on this, Robin?
I think just those practical tips of helping yourself switch it from type one to type two when it's needed. What else could this be? I think having a simple question that you check in with yourself, is there anything that doesn't fit? And or like you said, what is the thing that is the most important thing not to miss, which I think is a MRTA, important diagnosis not to miss here.
And then remaining reflective practitioners, because this is all about reflection, isn't it, really, to identify these things. Well, thank you, Robin. That is fabulous. Really appreciated our chat today. And I'll look forward to seeing you next time, where we're going to catch up and talk about clinician well-being and some research that Robin's done. So make sure you look out for that podcast. Thanks, Robin.
Pleasure as always, and just hi to all those guys out there doing the hard marketing. Keep up the great work, everyone.